Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Josh Morgenthau, and he is the owner and operator of Fishkill Farms up in the Hudson Valley in New York. And he produces eco-certified apples and orchard fruit, berries, vegetables on 150 acres of land. And I'm really excited to be introducing him all to you in just a little bit. But first, I want to talk about some things going on in the news, some ways you can take some action, and also, of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So first, I would like to just celebrate the fact that glyphosate has finally been added to the list of ingredients in California that is known to cause cancer. And it's been something that Californians and others have really been fighting for. Glyphosate, as you know, is a toxic pesticide that herbicide that we've been trying to make illegal in the country. That has not happened yet, but at least it now is listed in California as a chemical known to cause cancer. And since so much of our produce comes out of California, hopefully that means they will stop using it in California. But also this time of year, with everyone sunbathing and looking to get tan, I mentioned it last week too, but I want to just remind everybody that all sunscreens are not created equal. And so if you are one that puts sunscreen on to protect yourself from UV rays, please educate yourself as to the different types of sunscreen. You can find a great list on the Environmental Working Group's website, which is EWG.org. Consumer Reports just published a great article about sunscreens and what is actually in them and what things you need to watch out for. People don't realize that our skin is our largest organ, and that everything we put on our skin gets absorbed into our body. And this time of year, with everybody lathering on sunscreen, especially on children who are so much more susceptible to these toxins, we really need to be mindful of which sunscreens we buy and purchase. So check out the website or the list at environmentalworkinggroup.org and, choose sunscreens that don't have the toxic chemicals in them. Also, during the summer, kids all year long who are living in insecure households with or food insecure households where they don't know where their next meal is coming from, at least know that during the week they can get lunch at school. But what happens in the summer? And I've really, been reading a lot about this problem. And in the summertime, there are so many kids that go hungry because they don't get their school lunch. And so there are places where kids can go to get summer meal programs. And I have the list on my website, places you can go. And with Trump, cutting SNAP, cut in his budget, cutting the SNAP benefit program, these kids who are living in poverty are going to be hurt that much more. And so right now, if you know anybody out there, any children that are living in an insecure food household, please go to the website Summer Food Service Programs and find out where you can get summer meals, or summermealsny.org if you're in the New York area. But I know there's programs all across the country to get meals to kids who are hungry in the summer. And, the problem in this country is just so widespread. I had my guest the week before last, Andy Fisher, was talking about in his book, Big Hunger, the real problem with hunger in this country, and that food assistance programs, food pantries are not the way to deal with this problem, that we really need to get to the core of poverty in order to really fix the hunger problem. But in the meantime, food pantries do meet a need and take care of the immediate hunger problem. And so for families who have children in the summer, they can be making use of these summer meal programs. So please help us to spread that word and make sure that kids are not going hungry this summer. Lots of things going on in and around the city I want to tell you about. Oco Farms, which is a great farm in Brooklyn. I interviewed Yemi Amu, one of the co-owners of this farm, last year. But they've been having regular workshops on aquaponics and designing your own aquaponics. And they have their next one this Saturday, July 15th. And so if you're interested in aquaponics, you know, designing a system where you can raise fish while fertilizing your vegetables, it's a great opportunity. So check that out. I'll be leaving on Thursday, actually right after this show, for Denver for Slow Food Nations. And Slow Food Nations is a big event organized by Slow Food USA to bring all kinds of food producers and entrepreneurs and chefs and educators all together in one city for a weekend of tastings and tours and talks and panel discussions, and it should be a big event. Many of you who have been following me know that every other year I try to go to Terra Madre, which is in Turin, Italy, for that event, and it has opened up so many doors for me and taught me so much, and this is going to be a similar opportunity right here in Denver. So if you are in the Denver area or you have the opportunity to head out to Colorado for this event, it should be excellent. July 21st, there's the Food Truck Rodeo, which is a fundraiser taking place right here in Malvern, which is in Nassau County on the South Shore. And they have a bunch of food trucks coming. I think they planned this a few weeks ago, and it was rained out. So this is the rescheduled date, Friday, July 21st, and you can go to Crossroads Farm website to find out more about that. There's also a truck derby that happens every year out in the Hamptons. That's on August 11th in Bridgehampton, and that's a really huge, they call it the Great Food Truck Derby, and there's lots of food trucks to that one as well, so save the date for that. City Growers is having a workshop, a summer workshop, at Brooklyn Grange on Northern Boulevard in Long Island City on Saturday, July 22nd at 5:30. And that's an opportunity to learn about holistic and homeopathic herbs with City Growers educator Sarah Hurwitz. So that should be a wonderful thing. Oco Farms is also having a culinary tour on the same day, July 22nd. There's a benefit dinner to support Change Food on July 24th called Rise Up. And Change Food is a wonderful organization organized by Diane Hatz, who used to organize TEDx Manhattan. And she would love your support. It should be a great event as well. That's at Rouge Tomate in the Village. So, oh, I'm sorry. No, it's not in the Village. It's on 126 West 186th Street. So it's definitely not in the Village. But that should be a fun thing to do. There's also a Latin dance party up on the High Line, which should be a fun thing to check out. And I'm sure they'll have some Latin food there for all of us to taste as well. And then on August 12th, there's a compost tour, which is being organized by New York City Compost Project at the Queens Botanical Garden. And this should be really great for anyone who wants to learn about composting. I've been composting for years, and I still don't think I do it right. I have to work on that. I put my compost all over my garden, and then I realized that the seeds have not been killed. My compost must not get hot enough because I have little baby volunteer tomato plants and melons and all the seeds that I would have liked to have died in my compost still want to sprout. So learning more about compost is really a good thing to do. So check that out. I'd like to share a recipe with you. During the summer, with all the vegetables coming out of the garden, I'm constantly making, you know, a vegetable stir fry, and I very often, you know, am rushed for time during the week, so I use different pastas. This is a quinoa fusilli pasta, garden primavera, and depending on who's at, in your home, most of the time I'm eating vegetarian, but sometimes I do eat fish, and if I'm entertaining or I have somebody at the house who I know would really appreciate that, I keep some wild frozen shrimp in my freezer, and that defrosts really fast. And so this recipe that I want to share with you is a garden primavera with a shrimp option, because if you have, you know, different people in your household who eat different things, it's really such a wonderful tool to be able to make one dish and be able to just add something to it to satisfy everybody. So the shrimp can be made on the side super easily and just added to this garden primavera, and so everybody can be happy. So I cook the fusilli according to the directions, a little al dente. And when you're cooking pastas that are brown rice or brown rice and quinoa together, after you cook it, you do want to run it under some water to wash off all the starch. Very often a lot of the starch comes off in the water, and the water gets really clumpy and cloudy, and the pasta is sitting in that. So you want to wash that off. Otherwise, it becomes mushy. So that's a trick that I am sharing with you. You need some olive oil, one onion that you're going to chop up, two carrots chopped, 2 tablespoons chopped garlic, 1 bunch of broccoli cut into florets, 2 organic tomatoes deseeded and chopped, 1/4 cup of white wine, 1/4 cup of fresh Italian parsley, 3 tablespoons of pine nuts, 1/4 teaspoon red pepper flakes, salt and pepper to taste. And for the shrimp, in a separate pan, a cast iron pan, I just had some frozen wild shrimp, and I added some olive oil with that, 6 cloves of minced garlic, 2 tablespoons of white wine, and fresh parsley again. So you cook up the pasta, and while the pasta is cooking, you're going to stir-fry the onions in some olive oil in a wok until the onions are translucent, then add the carrots and the garlic. Add the broccoli and any other greens that you might have from the garden, Swiss chard, kale, collards, whatever you have, you can throw that in as well. And cook that for about 5 to 7 minutes till everything is cooked but not overcooked. Add more broccoli if needed, or you can add a little bit of water if you don't want to add more oil to the dish. And when you're adding olive oil in the middle of cooking, always drizzle it in around the edge of the wok so that by the time it gets down to the bottom, it's hot. And that really helps keep everything cooking smoothly. Add more garlic if desired. Add the white wine and let the vegetables just steam a little bit in the white wine. Then add the tomatoes, the parsley, and the pine nuts. If you like to have a little spice, this is when you would add the red pepper flakes and salt and pepper to taste. Mix in the pasta and garnish it with more parsley and pine nuts if you'd like. And then you're just going to add the shrimp right on top to 1/2 of it, to the people who want the shrimp, or you could keep the shrimp on the side. But basically for the shrimp, I defrosted it in water, pat it dry so that it's dry when you're putting it into your pan, and I used a cast iron frying pan, covered the bottom with some olive oil, put the shrimp in, added the garlic. And shrimp takes only a couple minutes to cook. You know, you're going to cook one side, then turn it over to the other side. When it's just about finished, splash it with the white wine and the fresh parsley, salt and pepper, and that's it. It's just so easy and simple, and then you just put that on top of the pasta, and it's a great dish. So enjoy, and as always, if you make this dish, please let me know how you like it. And any suggestions. And you can always find me at bhavani@ieatgreen.com. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest to all of you. Josh Morgenthau is the owner and operator of Fishkill Farms, which is up in the Hudson Valley of New York. And the farm has been in operation since 1913. They produce eco-certified apples and orchard fruit, organic berries, vegetables and pastured poultry on 150 acres of land. And since 2008, Josh has overseen the farm's expansion, putting 100 acres of land back into production, starting a 400-member CSA, attending five local farmers' markets every week, and expanding the store and pick-your-own operations. And in 2009, Josh and his family permanently conserved the 270-acre property with assistance from the state and Dutchess Land Conservancy. And most recently, Fishkill Farms has begun producing craft hard cider using homegrown apples, and they're planning on the construction of a on-farm cidery and tasting room. Josh also serves on the board of the Hudson Valley Agricultural Research Laboratory, on Glenwood Farms Advisory Committee, and on the American Farmland Trust New York Council. And so, Josh, are you with me?
I am, yes. Thanks for having me.
Sure, and thank you for joining us. You sound like a busy guy.
This time of year, it's nonstop.
Well, thank you for making time to... Thank you for making time to join us on the show, because I know how busy a farmer's life is, especially this time of year.
Well, it's my pleasure.
So can you share with us a little bit about your farm? Now, was it always in your family? Did you inherit it, or is it something that your family purchased?
My grandfather, Henry Morgenthau Jr., we went to Cornell and studied agriculture, and then he'd spent a summer working on a ranch in Texas, and his original intention was to be a rancher, but his father wanted to keep him closer to home, and he was in New York City, and he said, I hear they've have some really nice apple orchards in Dutchess County, and so he ended up buying an apple orchard, and it was originally both orchard and commercial dairy and kind of diverse farm. Originally over 1,000 acres in 1913, and the farm has been in continuous operation since then. It's been in the family since then.
Wow! So originally he had over 1,000 acres.
Yeah.
Now, how many acres do you have now?
Yeah, like a lot of farms in the area, sort of high cost of doing business and so the adverse impacts of sort of national produce trade with the highway system and now global produce trade with produce coming in, the commodity produce coming in very cheaply from other areas. A lot of farms struggled, especially, in the second half of the 20th century. And so the farm did downsize over the years. And actually my father, Robert Morgenthau, was only one of his three siblings to keep his piece going. So it was split into three pieces, and it's now we have 270 acres of land, and like you said, about 150 acres of that is farmland. So the farm has seen a lot of changes over time, but we're at a really, really great point, in the farm's history, in large part because of the renewed interest in local food, and we're very lucky to be located only 70 miles north of New York City. So we get a lot of people who are interested in coming and visiting the farm and seeing an actual productive farm and picking their own produce. And that's really been the kind of prime driver behind allowing us to expand again. And, I think we're actually at a point where down the line we're looking at leasing other land, actually a piece of property which was originally part of the farm, and hopefully I'd love to look back in 10 or 20 years and have overseen the first time that the farm has grown again since it came into the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is an exciting time for local produce, and the movement, it doesn't seem like it's just a trend. It seems like it's here to stay, so that I think that's a great thing, and I think the more that people are becoming educated about our food system and, you talked about foods being imported from other places and not really knowing what's happening to that food when it's coming in from somewhere else. I think a renewed interest in really knowing your farmer and knowing where your food comes from is really so crucial.
It definitely is. And that is, has been the driver, and I think it's keeping a lot of local farms, especially farms that are trying to push the envelope in terms of how they're growing, whether it's by growing their crops organically or ecologically. You know, there's a lot of different gradations in how you can grow produce and how you can operate a farm, and doesn't have to be organic to be better than this, you know, status quo.
Sure.
And so, you know, for a lot of farms, that interest in, you know, from the from eaters in knowing more about where their food comes from and wanting to seek out higher quality produce is helping a lot of farms that I think may have been headed towards
real estate.
Place where they, yeah, to real estate, exactly.
Development.
It's helping them stay afloat. And so, you know, that direct market connection certainly allows us to push the envelope and to do a lot of things in terms of land stewardship and ecological growing and environmentally sound farming that we wouldn't be able to afford to do if we had to sell into the commodity supply chain.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, I know you said that you grow eco-certified apples and orchard fruit. Can you share with my listeners, what is the difference between something that's eco-certified versus organic?
Sure. Well, we could spend the whole time talking about that because it's a very nuanced subject. I think to boil it down, I can sort of relate some of my history. When I came back to the farm in 2007, 2008, my commitment was to grow everything organically. But historically, the farm has been an orchard. Our soil and our terrain, you know, terrain, you know, hillside land that we have is really suited for orchard production. It's some of the best soil in the world for growing orchard fruit. And I quickly realized that growing orchard fruit organically is neither as easy as I thought it would be or necessarily as sustainable for our climate as I thought it would be. And, you know, as I was saying before, there's a lot of gradations in terms of how you farm, and especially with, you know, the EPA, which didn't exist 50 years ago, or was, you know, founded in the 70s. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of oversight and a lot of information that we have about the impacts of different crop protectants, whether they're organic or not organic, that we never had before. And so you can make a lot of choices, such as to use, you know, only the gentlest conventional crop protectants and to only use them when you absolutely need to. So instead of just spraying toxic pesticides as a matter of course, as a sort of prophylactic cautionary approach, you can take a much more active role in monitoring what pests and diseases may be a threat to your crop or maybe what may be happening in the field, and then only spray when you absolutely have to. And so I realized pretty quickly that the Hudson Valley and our climate is just the right combination of moisture and heat and natural pests and disease issues to make it very, very difficult to grow tree fruit organically. And I found over time this program called EcoApple. It's essentially a grower based cooperative with a third party nonprofit company called Red Tomato administering it, and then a third-party institute called the IPM Institute of North America that monitors and looks at all of the different crop protectants that are available and says, you know, these things are on the do not use list. They're either known carcinogens or they're toxic to the ecosystem. But then there's a whole set of non-organic but very low impact conventional materials that are available to farmers now, and those are on the you know, okay to use list. And in order to use them, we have to show you know, sort of documentation that there's a pest present. And so that program has allowed us to really, has given us a framework to focus on growing our tree fruit, not organically, but very close to organically. And in fact, more than half of the things that we do in terms of inputs that we're applying, whether it's fertilizer or a fungicide, are organic certified materials. And so we get very close to organic, but also we can grow a crop. And we have a block, about a third of our apple acreage is organically certified. And so it's a split operation. And in a good year, we have a beautiful organic crop. But in a bad year, we have very few organic apples. And so it's not something that we could sustain for the whole farm, but it actually allows us to, you know, every year we try different things and we get better and better at it. And we're actively mm-hmm. working to increase that acreage. But at the same time, I'm very proud and, you know, big believer in the eco, you know, certification and the sort of ecological approach to growing. And, you know, it's often one of those cases where the perfect is the enemy of the good that, you know, sure. Of course, if, you know, as a farmer, I'd love to just not spray at all and not, and just let my crops grow, but I need to make sure that we have a crop and we can keep our employees, you know, on the payroll and that we have someone to sell and keep the farm in business.
Right. Right. You know, I remember early on when I started these interviews and getting more involved in the food movement and the Farm Bureau and, you know, the head of the Long Island Farm Bureau, to him, you know, sustainable just meant that the farm could survive. And as I've talked over the years to more and more farmers, I really empathize and have so much understanding of when you're dependent on that as your livelihood, you know, you can't risk not having a crop, like you said. You really, too many people are dependent on it, not just you, but the people that work for you, et cetera. But your commitment to doing things as sustainable as possible is wonderful. And for my listeners, I just want to say, for those that don't know what IPM is, it's Integrated Pest Management. And, you know, as you said, you know, you want to use chemicals as little as possible. And the ones, and I've heard this many times before, some of the organic ones, you know, have a heavier footprint than some of the less toxic ones that aren't certified organic. So,
yeah, absolutely. And just to expand on that, you know, when you look at sustainability, you really have to look at the big picture. And for sure, part of that is keeping the farm in business, but it's also a matter of food access. I mean, right now, you know, I've run the numbers, and if we were to only produce organic apples and not manage, you know, some of our acreage with an ecological non-organic approach, we'd have to charge somewhere around $5 a pound for them. And you just have to think about what that in the current marketplace and the sort of social and economic structure, that type of a price point for local organic fruit pretty quickly rules out that fruit being accessible to all but, you know, the wealthiest people. And so that's something I think about. And it's also making sure that you have the financial resources to pay your employees a fair wage. So there's so many other factors, you know, to sort of weigh when you're looking at how you grow food. And so all of those are, you know, things that I'm thinking about when I make decisions as to how we're going to manage our crops. And then, of course, just the benefit of keeping land open and, you know, keeping the ecosystems that are thriving on farms around. The alternative is usually, and at least in our area, is housing development, which is much less rich ecologically. So Those are you know, some of the rationale for taking a more pragmatic approach. But then also the, you know, as you said, organic materials and organic, in, at least in our climate, is not always more sustainable. And a lot of that has to do with what at this point is an antiquated sort of protocol and set of definitions for organic farming. When the organic farming movement started, it was a bunch of farmers who really were operating in an information vacuum. A lot of the pesticides that were being used at the time were highly toxic, and there wasn't a lot of research as to what the long-term impacts of those pesticides were on people and on the environment. But, you know, sort of starting with Rachel Carson and Silent Spring and DDT, farmers and consumers started to become acutely aware that the way we were farming was really harmful in so many ways. But since then, our understanding and knowledge of different crop protectants has developed, you know, in leaps and bounds. But that definition that makes something organic and sort of defines organic farming versus non-organic is still rooted in either was it made, you know, is it a synthetic that was made in a lab, or was it naturally derived? And that was a good starting point for the organic movement in that information vacuum. But it turns out that a lot of organic materials, such as copper and sulfur, permethrin, which is called Pyganic, it's a insecticide that's organic approved, and it's derived from chrysanthemum flowers, but it's broad spectrum and completely wipes out any all beneficial insects on your farm. And at the same time, I have some synthetics that, you know, have a much softer footprint, as you said, and don't, you know, they target one cycle of a specific pest's life, you know, a life cycle, and thereby they don't harm, you know, other, you know, beneficial insects and pollinators, and they're not as toxic. So as I started to learn more about the materials that I was working with, I realized, you know, it's not as black and white as organic and conventional, and sometimes a more nuanced approach that's not organic but is, you know, weighing all of those factors carefully is much more sustainable and guarantees a good crop.
Right. But, you know, I always tell people that they really, you need to have a conversation with the farmer, because the standard industrial agricultural system that still raises the, you know, most of our fruits and vegetables in this country is not being done with a consciousness of the footprint. You know, I wish it was, but you're doing it as an organic farmer, even if everything is not 100% certified, but your care and your commitment to the planet is similar to someone who's doing organic. You know, you're caring about it. Where I think, you know, some of the huge farms that raise, you know, so much of our corn and wheat and cotton and whatever is really damaging the planet. So, you know, people just have to have a conversation with the farmer. And I think you look them in the eye and talk to them. And, you know, if you understand what you're talking about, you know, I think people will hear that and hopefully be able to make the right decision. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the workers that you have on your farm, because I know on Long Island, so many of the farmers that I've talked to are feeling the pinch with the immigration issues that we're dealing with right now. And so many of the workers that they had that would come back year after year are not able to get into the country. So how has that impacted you?
Yeah. Well, it's definitely had an impact. We are, you know, being a pick-your-own farm and very public facing, we really don't have the option of hiring undocumented workers. And, you know, I think that's ultimately a really good thing. But the, you know, there has been a huge impact, not only on farms that are relying on undocumented workers, which is a whole, it's a long conversation, but right now, based on the demand, you know, the sort of labor market, there isn't the volume of, documented workers to
who want to do that
to
kind
take
of work.
Care of the farms. Yeah, to take care of the farms in the country now. So it's at this point a necessary evil. But for us, we rely on employees that come in as migrant workers on a farm labor visa called an H-2A visa. And that's a program that's been in place for almost 100 years. And the issues with that program are that there's a lot of bureaucracy. Every year we have to reapply to get our the same sort of farm help. And at this point, they're like members of the family, and they know we have a crew of about 12 employees that come in every year, and each of them have different areas of specialization and are tremendously vital to our operation. But every year we have to reapply and wait for the paperwork to clear through several government departments. And, a few years back, we didn't get our approvals to, you know, the visas to bring our workers in. And we, you know, called to try to figure out what was going on. And it turned out that they had misfiled our applications. You know, they'd assigned it a number that was one digit off from what we'd put in. And instead of rectifying the situation, they made us reapply from the start, and it delayed our help from coming in by about 2 months. And we actually weren't able to pick a lot of our strawberries that year.
Wow.
It was really, really demoralizing and difficult, economically and just in general. And that's the type of thing that's a really, I think the attitude is not, it's not at this point pro farmer or pro farm worker, and it's getting worse. And there's a lot of uncertainty about that program continuing to exist. And so we're certainly, we're kind of sitting tight and hoping that things work out for the best, but it has impacted us.
Mm-hmm. And you said they're part of your family, so do you put them up? You have a place for them to live when they come?
We do. We do. We have housing, for all of them. Our workforce is pretty diverse on the farm in terms of age and nationality and kind of in every way. Our production crew, half of our production crew comes in through that H-2A visa. They mostly come from Jamaica, and we put all of them up. But then we do have a lot of, domestic and local helpers that come in seasonally, and some of them year-round. And some of them we also provide housing for, and some of them live locally. So it's a mix, pretty diverse mix.
Mm-hmm. And what about woofers? Do you get many woofers that come through you? For those that don't know, that's what does that stand for? World
Willing Workers
Organic.
On Organic Farms.
There you go.
We don't. I think that program works really well for very small farms, where it's sort of a mom and pop operation, and they need some seasonal help. The general idea of the program is volunteers that come in and have no farm experience. And for our scale of farming, farming 150 acres, it's been critical to us to find ways, and especially as we've pushed the envelope to be more sustainable and organic wherever possible, finding ways to reduce labor and to use tractors and tools and mechanical implements as much as possible has been really critical. So we've become fairly kind of technologically advanced in how we're mm-hmm. farming, which means that there's a little bit less of an opportunity for people who are completely green in the sense that they don't have a farm background. So generally on the production side, we are hiring help that either have been with the farm for years or have worked on other farms of our scale or similar scale for at least one season. So that's the reason we don't work with that program.
Right. Let's take a couple-minute break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about how your CSA runs, because I know you do it a little different. You also have picking. You know, people can pick their own, and you provide a CSA, and you also do farmers markets. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Josh Morgenthau, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green.
Progressive Radio Network. The Thinking Person Station.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Josh Morgenthau. He is the owner and operator of Fishkill Farms, a Hudson Valley family farm in New York. And so, Josh, I wanted to ask you about how you run your CSA. I know there's many different models of CSAs. You know, some people have their clients or customers pick their own. Some people come and, you know, have it displayed and people just go through the boxes and fill up their own bag. And some people come and show up and there's a box already packed up for them. How do you do it?
Yeah. So we have like every other part of our operation, a pretty unique, I think, way of running our CSA. We started the CSA in 2011 with 30 members, and it's grown every year, you know, up until a few years ago, it sort of leveled out at a little over 300 members. But because we are a pick-your-own farm and we're set up with all of the signage and the kind of the sort of facilities to host the public, we from the get-go thought that it would be a great idea to have a pick-your-own CSA. And it really kind of, I think, in keeping with the farm's a big piece of our mission, which is not only growing great food for local customers and nourishing our community with food, but giving them some of the insight and the excitement and enlightenment and fun of visiting the farm and picking their own produce. And I really am a firm believer in that experience as one of the most kind of formative and amazing ways to educate children about food and food production, and also just a wonderful activity. So we have this pick your own CSA, and we wind up doing a mix about for our members that are picking up on the farm, about 60% of the produce we pre-pick for members, and the other the remainder they can pick themselves. So we send out a weekly email on Thursdays telling them what's in their share and what we're going to be picking for them and what they're going to be responsible for picking. And then they come. We have a pretty extended window of a few days that they can come and pick the produce and then pick up the pre-picked portion of their share.
Uh-huh. So it's not like a two-hour window. They really can kind of work it into their schedule a little bit more.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
I would think logistically with 150 acres, you know, you might have the kale over, you know, on this field, and you might have the broccoli over in that field. I mean, how much time will it take for somebody to pick 40% of their CSA share?
Yeah. Well, that's a completely right and a good point. And so we actually have a dedicated pick your own garden for CSA members. So most of the vegetables that they're picking are coming out of that garden, and that's right by our farm store, and it's near where we have parking. So it's a little bit easier to get into the field for them.
Okay, but then so they don't we have do to spend our, hours hiking from one end of the 150 acres to the other side.
We try to minimize it, but there are at the same time for the fruit portion, most of our berries are right kind of centrally located near our farm store and parking, but then we have some peaches and cherries and when we get to apples that are spread out throughout the farm, and so we do have to give them maps and tell them where they're going. And for crops that are quite a distance, we'll let them drive their cars right down our farm road and go, you know, drive right up to the crops.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I would think that might be necessary sometimes.
I think they they appreciate it.
Yeah, so I'm so happy to hear how your CSA program has grown, because I've been getting, you know, little bits of information where people are saying that CSAs are, you know, not growing as much as they were a few years ago, and that people are cutting back and going more towards these delivery services of, you know, a basket being delivered to your house of just fresh fruits and vegetables, and or, you know, programs like Blue Apron that, you know, gives you a quarter of an onion if that's all the recipe needs and, you know, whatever. Have you seen any need to change your model, or what you're doing is working for you?
Well, I mean, I think we saw great growth since we started the CSA. And you know, I think part of that has been that we have a pretty unique farm, both in allowing our members to pick their own produce, but also just the diversity of fruit that we grow. Most of the CSA farms in the area focus on vegetables, and if they have a fruit component, they're usually buying from another farm, and we actually do sell some fruit to some other CSAs. But mm-hmm. being that we grow both fruits and vegetables, it's really set us apart. At the same time, the last few years, we have seen our membership kind of plateau and stay where it is. We don't see it as a huge kind of opportunity for growth down the line. And I think part of that is, like you said, there are both new services available, but also, you know, there have been more farmers markets started up in New York City and around the state than mm-hmm. there ever were before. And so access to local food in a variety of ways is improving. And then retailers are getting into local. And that's ultimately a good thing. You know, as much as the CSA model is a wonderful piece of our operation, and I think maybe the most rewarding part of our operation because we get to form such a strong relationship with our members, you know, it's not something that I think is going to grow much from here on out. So we are, you know, we've had to look at other areas for growth, and I mean we're going to talk about hard cider, but that's one of them. And long term, our strategy is more and more we're really trying to find ways to make the farm an even more exciting and kind of inviting place for people to visit and come and buy their own produce, whether it's pick your own or from our farm store. And so that's the area that we see is has the most potential for us.
Mm-hmm. You said in addition to your farm store, you also service many farmers markets. Do you come down to the city for them, or are they mostly up in your area?
No, we do. We have three farmers markets through Green Market in New York City. They're all in Brooklyn. We do Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn on Sunday, and Windsor Terrace on Sunday, and then Borough Hall on Saturday. And then we also go to the Tarrytown Farmers Market on Saturdays, and Beacon, which is right near, it's 15 minutes from the farm, on Sundays.
Mm-hmm. I love Beacon. Such a great little town.
It's a great little city.
Uh-huh. So you're also starting a craft cider operation. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the sort of way we got into it is a little interesting story, but I've been making hard cider kind of as a hobby thing for friends and family for about 10 years and have, learned at least to know, you know, everything I don't know and sort of at that stage, but have gotten better and better results. But really the impetus for that was last spring, spring of 2016, actually from the winter through the spring, we had a series of really devastating freezes and weather events that damaged our fruit crop. We lost all of our peaches and nectarines, and about 60% of our apple crop was lost to those freezes. And so we had been, I'd been thinking about hard cider for years and actually had been planting a lot of heirloom apples, historic apple varieties that you can't find in supermarkets, you know, because they've fallen out of favor, you know, either because they don't store as well or they don't look as pretty or the flavor is, you know, interesting but not, doesn't have mass appeal. But a lot of those varieties are the best apples that you can grow for hard cider. And so I've been thinking about it for a while, but actually that losing so much of our crop made me really realize that we needed to find a way to diversify our operation a little bit more and find a way to insulate ourselves a little bit from the what may be increasingly common weather events that can hurt our crop. You know, it's hard to say whether there's more more frost events now because of climate change, but it, you know, we've had in the last 5 years two winter and spring freezes that were kind of rated as historic, like 1 in 30 year occurrences. So it's starting to feel like a pattern. But we decided then, you know, I decided we need to find a value added product that we can make with our apples in a good year, and then sell it that year, and then sell it the next year, and thereby not be so reliant on each year's apple crop being consistently good. And so, you know, it was around that time that I decided to take the recipe that I'd been working on and make it in the real large volume and, you know, have these amazing older apple varieties that make wonderful hard cider. And for those who don't know, cider is really just apple wine. It's fermented apple juice. And so like wine, if you're trying to make good wine with grapes that you get at the supermarket, you're not going to have good results. But if you have the right varieties, it's a completely different ball game. So the results of our first year's production, which we made with the 2015 crop, some apples that we still had in storage, were really great. And we have another batch, you know, that's finished fermenting, and we're going to start blending and bottling it soon. So we're really excited about the direction it's taking us. And it becomes one more thing to offer.
I'm sorry. I was just asking you how long hard cider has to ferment for.
Well, it's, you know, if you rush the fermentation, you know, some companies are doing it, you know, doing their primary fermentation in just a few weeks and then bottling. But to make really fine traditional hard cider, you want to let it ferment through the winter and then age in bulk in the tank into the spring, and then, you know, bottle sometime in the summer. And that aging and the slower fermentation at cooler temperatures really helps develop character and rounds out some of the harsh edges of cider. So, you know, I think there's sort of two worlds of cider making now. There's what I'd call commercial cider, which is often rushed and, you know, maybe not using the best quality fruit and the right varieties, and the fermentation is rushed, and then it has to rely on a lot of carbonation, a lot of sugar to make up for inherent lack of character. And then you have, you know, what I'd think of as orchard cider or more of an artisan cider that is generally fermented more slowly and aged.
Mm-hmm. Sounds delicious.
It's, yeah.
Do you sell that at the farmer's market?
We now sell it at all our farmer's markets and at the farm store, and then we have a new website that has some of the restaurants and retail stores that we've begun to sell to. So we have some stores and restaurants in New York City and in the Hudson Valley.
Uh-huh. Can you share with us your website so if anybody wants to order any,
yeah,
they can
and so
go
I should
on?
Probably tell the name of the hard cider. It's not just Fishkill Farms hard cider. It's called Treasury Cider, and it's actually an homage to my grandfather, who, and I didn't cover this history earlier, fascinating history, but he went, he was friendly with FDR when FDR was his Hyde Park neighbor, and they became friends, and he went on to serve as conservation commissioner in New York when FDR was governor, and then he went on to become Secretary of the Treasury. So he went from farming into public service, and Treasury Cider kind of to honor him, but also I think there's some resonance with the history of cider making and thinking of the orchard and the cider cellar as a treasury of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
But the website is treasurycider.com.
Great. I'll share that on my website, too, so people can find it. And lastly, I just want to know, do you have any upcoming events that you have at your farm that are open to the public if people wanted to come up and visit?
We just had a really fun July sort of Independence Day event, and our next event is in August. It's our annual peach festival called Peachtopia. And that is the second weekend in it's August 12th, Saturday, August 12th.
Okay.
Yeah, and we'll have information on that event on our website, which is fishkillfarms.com.
Perfect. Well, I will share that. I hear our music, so it seems like we are out of time. Sorry to rush you at the end. But everyone listening, you've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green with my guest Josh Morgenthau from Fishkill Farms. Thank you, Josh. And
thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone out
me.
There who's been listening. And I'll see you all again next week. I'm a